It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, narcissism.
You ask me if I have a God complex. Let me tell you something. I am God.
I thought we were talking about me.
Narcissism, 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 the narcissistic epidemic. And there is Facebook and fame and fortune. Who is the famous one?
Facebook is a narcissist's dream come true, since it provides an endless arena of adoration.
And is self-admiration compared to self-esteem?
Narcissists take criticism terribly, partly because, in many cases, it's actually a masquerade to hide its exact opposite, a deep well of self-loathing and lack of self-esteem.
I thought we were talking about me. What, again with you?
Nobody wants to be a narcissist. One of those relentless self-promoters. The person who thinks everything he does is great. Or who can't stop talking about herself. But look at Facebook or Twitter, and that could be any of us, right? And in social media, we all talk about ourselves all the time. Post selfies. Tweet our lunch plans. So maybe this really is a golden age of narcissism. Jeffrey Kluger is editor-at-large at Time Magazine and Time.com. He's also the author of The Narcissist Next Door, Understanding the Monster in Your Family, in Your Office, in Your Bed, in Your World. Steve Paulson talks with him.
Jeffrey, you have a very short dedication at the beginning of your book. Could you tell us what it is?
Yes, I dedicated the book to me. And it seemed entirely fitting. Now, in fairness, the original dedication was a little more over the top. At first, it was going to say, "What the hell with love to me?" But my editor, the very smart Jake Morrissey at Riverhead Books, said, "We want people not to quit taking you seriously on page one." So he asked me just to dial it down to, in keeping with the times, to me.
So I have to ask, are we living in the golden age of narcissism?
We are. It's a little more complex than that, but the numbers do suggest that over a 25-year period from 1979 to 2004, overall narcissism scores in the country, scores on the standardized test given to look at narcissism, have gone up about 30%. That's a very significant number over a very comparatively short time. And it's a time that entirely precedes social media, which tells you something about the fact that social media may be potentiating narcissism a little bit, but it's not behind the trend.
So how do you explain that? Why are we swimming in narcissists?
Well, we are terribly full of ourselves. There are a few things that I think are behind it. First of all, it's the unintended consequence of the very important self-esteem movement. Now, this is not ever to minimize the value of the self-esteem movement. There were so many people, and children especially, who were marginalized throughout the time they were growing up due to being awkward, different from other kids. Maybe they had some developmental issues. Maybe they just weren't terribly attractive kids. Whatever it was, they grew up with a profoundly low sense of self-esteem. And the self-esteem movement has done a lot to remind all children that they have something to offer, which is great. The problem is, it's a little like Lake Wobegon. We can't all be exceptional. We can't all be over 50%. And some students actually, in one poll, found that 75% of students consider themselves above average. Which is obviously another huge statistical impossibility.
Right.
It's also the everybody gets a medal ethos of the school track meet. The idea that the gold, red, and blue ribbons for first, second, and third place are now, you know, fifth place yellow ribbons and ninth place tan ribbons and all manner of different colors. Grade inflation has played a big role in it too. Grades overall have gone up in the U.S. in that same 25-year period about 20%. And yet, at the same time, amount of studying has gone down. So clearly, these kids are just getting a lot of high fructose A's and B's that they didn't really earn.
Okay, so we're telling people they're more special than they really are. Any other reasons for this rise in narcissism?
One of the things that isn't so much the rise in narcissism as much as its cultural or genetic stickiness is that it is thought to be about 77% heritable. Now, that doesn't mean that if you have a never-pinpointed narcissism gene, you will develop the disorder. It does mean that you're more predisposed to it than people who don't have whatever the suite of genes are. And narcissists, not to put too fine a point on it, but are very, very good at doing the one thing that's necessary to keep a genetic trait in the population, which is they breed a whole lot. Narcissists are very charismatic. They're thrilling people. They quite literally charm the pants off you. And, you know, even if they don't come back the next day, they leave a lot of little narcissists behind for you to remember them by.
So narcissists have a lot of sex.
A whole lot of sex, although it doesn't last long with any one person. They have a lot of serial sex.
Well, I think we should back up for a moment. How do you define a narcissist?
Well, that's a really good question with a somewhat complicated answer. Narcissism in its truly high-octane weapons-grade clinical form, which is what psychologists call narcissistic personality disorder, affects only about 1 to 3% of the population, which is pretty consistent with the other personality disorders like paranoia and histrionic personality, borderline personality, and so forth. But unlike those other disorders, it tends to exist also in a whole range of shades all the way down the behavioral spectrum. So while you may only have a few percent of the population with clinical NPD, you have a whole lot of other people with lowercase n narcissism. And it's all defined in varying degrees by a sense of grandiosity, a profound sense of entitlement, and an utter lack of empathy, which is the best way to continue being a narcissist, because if you have no ability to be aware of the effect you're having on the people around you, it's very easy to go on misbehaving. One of the things also that gives narcissists as much power as they have is they are incredibly charming, incredibly charismatic. They're full of energy. They make a sale very well, whether it's a literal sale or a friendship sale or a romantic sale. So we all get very easily drawn into their gravitational field.
So it's complicated. I mean, it's easy to say, oh, my God, keep these people away from me. They're just nothing but trouble. Actually, we like being around them, at least in short doses.
Absolutely. They're a real sugar buzz. And in a lot of ways, they do a whole lot of good. Narcissists have drive. Narcissists are the ones who are willing to step forward and push a great idea. Steve Jobs may have been a terrible person to work for, but he was a brilliant man, and he was profoundly narcissistic. The same is true of Bill Gates. The same was true in some ways of Jonas Salk and Albert Sabin. I mean, look, these two people developed the 1-2 punch that has effectively wiped out polio, except in three endemic countries left in the world.
Let's talk about a few of these people. Steve Jobs, why was he a narcissist?
Well, he was very abusive of his subordinates. He was terribly condescending. He was quite foul-mouthed. He would generally mock the work he didn't like and could be quite abusive even when he was courting people to come work for him. He once said to an employee at Xerox he was trying to hire, "Everything you've done in your life to this point is, let's say, crap," though he used a somewhat coarser word. He said, "Why don't you come work for me?" Now, this was typical of the way Steve Jobs would approach people. And yet, he was an icon, and he created iconic products. And the great irony about Steve Jobs is you could call it one of the most narcissistic marketing lines in history, or actually not narcissistic, but presumptuous, when one of the iPad ads, when it was just being introduced, was sold on the slogan, "You already know how to use it," which is quite remarkable because that is true of a lot of Apple products. And the reason it's true is because Jobs understood people. He did say, "Often the public doesn't know what they want until you give it to them." And he was right about that. So one of the great ironies of Steve Jobs is that he was profoundly attuned to what people want and what they need and what their appetites are, but he was terrible at appealing to those people on a one-to-one basis.
So it raises the question, if we're not working for someone like Steve Jobs, but we do have a narcissistic boss, any suggestions?
Well, run away as quickly as you can, certainly.
You're saying you can't reform these people.
Well, no, you can't reform these people. There's triage work you can do. There are ways you can protect yourself. Narcissists in general, but particularly narcissistic bosses, are terrible credit grabbers. Any idea that crosses their desk, they lay claim to. So it's often helpful to share your idea with your coworkers before you present it to your boss, and even better, present it for the very first time in a meeting where there are eyewitnesses as to whose idea it was. Bosses are also terrible about laying blame. Since the very idea of narcissism, or one of the qualifying features of narcissism, is that narcissists take criticism terribly, partly because in many cases narcissism, it comes from what's called the mask model of narcissism. It's actually a masquerade to hide its exact opposite, a deep well of self-loathing and lack of self-esteem. So when you feel terrible about yourself, any criticism at all leaves you very defensive and very threatened. As a result, the narcissist's ego is a very brittle thing.
I mean, that's interesting because, I mean, often when we see these people, I mean, charismatic, cocky, kind of prancing around, you're saying actually they're often covering up a kind of self-loathing?
Well, in many cases, not in all cases, by all means, and athletes, I think, are especially good examples of narcissism actually being exactly what it looks like, you know, a profound sense of exaggerated worth, a feeling of being outside the rules, a feeling of being infinitely more entitled than other people. And part of the reason is that athletes do operate outside the rules.
You also say that one of the traits of a lot of narcissists is they cheat, they lie.
They do cheat and lie because the ends are vastly more important to them than the means. I asked a couple of researchers about this because I was struck by the fact that, you know, you look at people who will cheat on a test or who will plagiarize someone's work. Well, the appeal, as any writer will tell you, of doing the work is the byline and knowing that it's an authentic byline. The appeal of winning a Super Bowl trophy isn't just the hardware you get. It's the fact that you know you did this thing. You know, if you win, I don't know, the Tour de France, think about Lance Armstrong, the appeal to it is knowing I really am better than anyone else at what I'm doing. I have achieved a very difficult thing. For narcissists, it's not about that. It's about the recognition. And if it's a fake A you score on a test, if it's a fake byline you just got because you plagiarized or made up everything you just wrote, or if it's a fake Tour de France because you juiced in 7 straight races, well, that's okay because the world thinks I'm better than everyone else. And the outside in view, what they think of me, is much more important than the inside out view, in part because often that inside out view already stinks.
Now, you did a lot of research for this book. You know, you looked into the nature of narcissism, personality traits. Did any of this hit home for you? I mean, did you ever sort of think, oh my God, you know, I'm like that in some ways.
Yeah, it did. Particularly in relationships. There were more than one occasion in my life when women I was involved with or friends would point out that I was a wee too interested in what I had to say and in sucking the air out of the room and a bit uninterested in what other people were saying. I did tend to dominate conversations. I did have a terrible sense of entitlement, and as I wrote in the book, you know, it got me fired from one job.
You have to tell that story. I mean, you write about this at the very end of the book.
Yeah, there was a boss I had who was terribly narcissistic. He had gotten his job in the first place by simply pitching a magazine company that they should launch a magazine, and oh yeah, they should hire him and give him control of the payroll, and they did. And you know, as I say in the book, you don't sink a half-court shot like that being shy. So I went to work for him. And I and a few other senior people, were having a conversation with him one day about, you know, the fact that we were overworked and underpaid, and that's a fairly common grievance. And in our case, it was manifestly true. But I kind of couldn't climb down from it. And the more I talked and the more voluble I became and the more insistent I got, the quieter my friends became. And if I had seen at all the put a lid on it signals they were probably sending me with their eyes. I certainly didn't notice them or respond to them. And in fact, I flattered myself to think, they've only gone silent because they don't have the courage I do and they're so impressed by my straightforwardness. So the next day I got to work and the boss's secretary said he wanted to see me, and I fully assumed that this was my raise and promotion, which I assumed I had argued for so effectively the day before. And in fact, it was a summary dismissal. It was the only time in my life I've ever been fired from a job. I was 31, which meant I was just far along enough in my career for it to really hurt and amount to a legitimate setback, but just young enough that I could overcome it without too much problem. But it did set me back a year or two in the tempo of my career. And I learned a lot. And yes, I was outraged for the first 6 months after he fired me. And it took me a long time to think, finally, but yeah, I might have been right, but I blew off way too much steam and I was flat out insubordinate. And narcissist though he may have been, he was well within his rights to can me, and he did.
Well, this is quite a fascinating topic. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. I love talking about this, actually. And I'm just vain enough that I could stay on the radio all day.
Jeffrey Kluger is the author of The Narcissist Next Door. He talked with Steve Paulson. Coming up, we'll learn how the idea of healthy narcissism took shape during the 1970s. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. The United States has been called the most narcissistic nation in the world. We invented Facebook, Twitter, selfies. We wear T-shirts that say things like, "World's Best Dad," and "What's your favorite part of talking to me?" Our politicians routinely call America the greatest nation in the world. So how did America get to be so full of itself? Producer Doug Gordon, who grew up in Canada, has often wondered that. So he reached out to Elizabeth Lundbeck, the author of The Americanization of Narcissism.
Elizabeth, do you think we're living in an especially narcissistic time right now?
That is what you would read in the popular media. And I'm certainly not going to argue that there's not a lot of narcissism out there, but the same argument was made in the 1970s about the baby boomers, and I'm among them, that we were the most narcissistic generation in history. So now we have the same argument being made again, the most narcissistic generation in history. I think, sure, there is a lot of narcissism, but as a historian, I'm suspicious when I hear these kinds of claims because it kind of posits that there was a golden age when we weren't this way, that things were completely different and our characters changed in the space of a decade or so. It's a little too simple for my mind, for my taste, but right, there is a lot of narcissism out there, but I would certainly not blanket the younger generation with that diagnosis. I think it's kind of sloppy thinking.
Yeah, and you mentioned the media, and of course the media has a tendency to amplify things that make for a good copy. They tend to speak in superlatives, and so now it's kind of a sexy and thing to get attention to say, oh, this is the most narcissistic time. This is the new golden age of narcissism.
Right. So bad news sells papers.
Yeah, exactly. If it bleeds, it leads.
Right. So that's part of it. But I'm also interested in the enduring fascination of the category, which I think the conversation speaks to.
Yeah. One of the things that researchers point to as evidence of this being an especially narcissistic age, rightly or wrongly, involves something called the Narcissistic Personality Inventory, or NPI. What exactly is the NPI?
The NPI is a 40-question forced choice test developed by psychologists in, I think, 1978 that offers subjects two very discrete possibilities to answer. So I think of myself as a good leader, or I don't mind following others. There's no gray in between. That's what it's a forced choice. It's a whole series of questions. You answer them, and then they're all added up so that you get a score. And much of the argument about narcissism being epidemic today is based on a slight, though if the sample's large enough, it's significant, increase in scores over time on the NPI. My problem with the NPI, and even some psychologists' problem with the NPI, is that it conflates, doesn't distinguish among traits that are actually considered by many to be signs of health and traits that are associated with a more malignant personality style. They're all just added together. It's not a dynamic way of understanding the personality. It's a static kind of picture of personality.
So you're saying then that narcissism isn't always a problem, that we can distinguish between malignant narcissism and a more healthy kind of narcissism?
Right. That is the sort of central issue in my book, is how did we lose sight of healthy narcissism? And I should say that healthy narcissism was not a creation of the me decade, the 1970s, but it was first outlined in 1930s Vienna by a psychoanalyst in an age of depression, shortage, asceticism, and so on. So it's not kind of an excrescence of our own narcissism. And the idea behind healthy narcissism is that you need a certain amount of sense of self, self-feeling, to do anything in the world.
Yeah.
That you can't accomplish anything without being a little bit narcissistic.
Yeah. You talk a lot about Christopher Lasch's 1978 book, The Culture of Narcissism. Can you tell me a bit about the book?
Well, the book was a sensation when it was published. And it would be hard to overstate that, because now we've kind of lost sight of psychoanalysis in the popular discussion. But it was a very psychoanalytically influenced book. It appeared to great acclaim.
Bestseller?
Oh, it was a bestseller. He visited the White House. Jimmy Carter talked to him, as Jimmy Carter's favorite book on sort of the self in American history. He was in People magazine. It also coincided with a renewed interest in narcissism within psychoanalysis. And he kind of brilliantly drew on the new writings about narcissism within psychoanalysis and his own cultural critique to fashion this wholesale indictment of the American character.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but Lasch saw a correlation between the decline of the U.S. and the rise in narcissism.
Right. So national character declines as narcissism is on the rise. It fits into a long tradition of social science, sociology, the sort of declensionist narrative that, you know, we're going to hell in a handbasket. But what I think gave it its particular allure is this new word, narcissism, which has a kind of appealing resonance to it. It sounds very learned. It's classical. It means that you're not just saying someone's a jerk, they're a narcissist. It conjures up a much more kind of interesting array of traits. He brilliantly brought that into the conversation about the failings of the American self.
Hmm. The title of your book, The Americanization of Narcissism, makes me wonder about the U.S.'s relationship with narcissism versus the way other countries experience narcissism. I'm wondering, is there something unique about the Americanization of narcissism versus, say, the Swedenization of narcissism or the Czech Republicization of narcissism?
Well, it's easier to say. It flows
off
the tongue
for sure.
More easily.
Yeah. A lot easier.
There's a kind of ambiguity in the title that's intentional. So many people would argue that America is the most narcissistic nation on earth. And my claim is it's hard to establish that one way or the other. I mean, there's all kinds of kind of cultural claims you could make about that. What I'm focused on is how it was appropriated in America and made an American malady in the 1970s. Britons looking at us and are worrying the concept in the 70s were like, what's going on with America? What's wrong with them? Why are they so self-flagellating? The rest of the world's caught up in their interest in narcissism, but it really was taken from a kind of clinical conversation into a public conversation by Americans and made part of a sort of ongoing cultural critique of ourselves in the 70s. So that's what I, in part, am referring to when I talk about the Americanization of the concept.
Yeah. And one of the people involved in this cultural critique is a psychoanalyst named Heinz Kohut. What did Kohut think about narcissism?
So Kohut's a really interesting figure. Viennese emigre, moved to Chicago, was for many years an Orthodox Freudian, and plotted, I would say, very brilliantly a kind of revolution within psychoanalysis around narcissism. Coet's contribution was to pick up earlier strands of thinking that had not really been woven together very well, having to do with the necessity for a certain amount of positive self-feeling. And his argument to his fellow psychoanalysts was there is such a thing as healthy narcissism, that grandiosity, exhibitionism in the young and children is part of a developmental process, and we should not immediately reprove our patients for their narcissistic strivings, but we should listen to them, allow them to develop a healthy sense of self. And this was very much against prevailing kind of very negative views of narcissism as a developmental arrest, as something associated with homosexuals, as something that there was not much good to say about. So
yeah.
Coet is really kind of the carrier of a notion of healthy narcissism.
So what can we do to redefine narcissism and embrace its positive qualities?
Well, I think the management literature is actually an interesting starting point, because there's a lot of sort of fascination with the charisma, independence, even more darkly, the lack of empathy among successful narcissists that I think offers the opportunity to reopen the conversation. And I think what we can do is stop making it a kind of us versus them argument, but think about it as us versus us, that we, the people, are drawn to people who exhibit a lot of narcissism in many cases. If narcissists were not attractive, it wouldn't be a problem. It would be very easy to say, no, go away, I'm not going to fall under your sway. The problem is that narcissists can be extremely skilled at drawing us into their project, into their ambit, and then we get used in ways that we're not fully aware of, but they feel very destabilizing and then cast aside. So I think sort of coming to terms with and in a way almost depathologizing narcissism and coming to terms with its ubiquity and its necessity will, I think, allow us to better deal with its malignant expressions.
Okay. Just be selective in terms of what management literature we choose to read. Like, we probably shouldn't read Al Dunlap's autobiography, Chainsaw Al, who laid off all those people at Sunbeam and ran the company into the ground.
He is seen as kind of an example of the narcissist who went over the line. But
yeah,
he was someone who had a vision and so on.
Elizabeth Lundbeck is the author of The Americanization of Narcissism. She spoke with Doug Gordon. So if you'd like to find out where you fall on the Narcissistic Personality Inventory Scale, there's a link to a quiz based on the NPI on our website at ttbook.org. So the opposite of self-love is self-loathing. And that's something Annalee Rufus is all too familiar with. A journalist and writer, she struggled with low self-esteem her whole life. And she recently summed up what she's learned about it in a book called Unworthy: How to Stop Hating Yourself.
A day in the life of someone with low self-esteem. When I say voices in your head, I don't mean necessarily like schizophrenic voices in your head. I mean, it's your own voice mostly, and it's the voice of whoever it was that pretty much gave you your low self-esteem, because someone or someones did back then somewhere. And those voices are saying, you can't do that. Oh, did you just do that? Oh, you were such a fool. Wait, wait. They're constantly making you wait so that every step you take is hesitant. Every gesture you make is hesitant. You apologize a lot because the voices in your head are telling you, you just screwed up again. What are those people thinking of you? And it's all about, even if, like myself, you're a complete introvert, a loner who doesn't really honestly care about other people's opinions, at some level, low self-esteem makes you care, and that does drive you pretty crazy.
Mm. Now, your premise is that you are very far from unique and that we're living in the midst of an epidemic of self-hatred. What makes you think that?
I see it everywhere. I see it in the people that chronically apologize. I see habits that I know I've had and that I know my mother, who hated herself for the 84 years of her life, also had. And I see these habits as being so prominent, so predominant, that I think, you know, this is something we have in common.
Habits like what?
Like faking it, like always aiming to please, like not being able to choose. That is a huge dead giveaway. For anything from choosing an ice cream flavor or a menu item to something big like the name of your baby or what you're going to do for a career, there is this hesitance. Whatever I choose is going to be wrong and I'm going to regret it, or someone else is going to regret it and be mad at me. And that is a huge problem people with low self-esteem have. And we don't even necessarily realize what is causing these habits. Perfectionism. Why are we so competitive? Why are we comparing ourselves to others? Because we're diligent? Because we want to be good? Yes. But behind that is often we're sure that we're not good and we're sure that we're worse than others, so we have to try extra hard and overcompensate for the flaws that we perceive.
Hmm. You must have, as a child, thought however you were was perfectly normal. Was there a point when you kind of woke up and thought and recognized that you have low self-esteem, or even began to name what you're describing as self-hatred?
In the book, I call that the time before, that all of us have a time before. We're not born with low self-esteem, because developmental psychologists say that we can't be, that babies are born bent completely on survival. They don't have a sense of self at all as such, for good or bad. They just must eat, live, and be warm. And only at age 3 do humans begin to recognize themselves as themselves in mirrors and kind of think about what they did before and what they're doing now and how they're different from others. And that, at that age, they say, is when low self-esteem can begin. Do I remember before age 3? I kind of do. I kind of do remember a peace and serenity. But that is very, very, very tiny compared to what I do remember.
Hmm. And do you remember becoming aware of or naming to yourself that you had low self-esteem, or that you disliked, hated yourself?
The sad, tragic, interesting thing about low self-esteem is that most people who really struggle with it don't realize that that is their problem. They would not necessarily tell you, "And I have low self-esteem." They would say, "I'm a screw up. I'm ugly. I'm fat. I'm horrible. I mess up everything. I'm stupid." They would say that, and then you'd say you have low self-esteem, and they'd say, "Yeah, because I deserve to," but they don't think that is their core problem, and I think it is their core problem. Mm. You know, as for me, I did not grow up thinking, per se, I have low self-esteem. I grew up thinking, I am so lame. I fall when I try to run. Everyone makes fun of me. Everyone thinks I'm weird. I can't do math. I can't do this. I can't do that. And mom and dad are always yelling at me, so I must be a terrible person.
I identify a lot with your description of internal negative monologue. I know what it's like to go through life feeling like you're never quite good enough. Is there something about American culture, do you think, that encourages self-criticism?
Well, there's been something in American culture since the mid-1980s that encourages quite the opposite. In 1985, a movement arose in California, starting with Assemblymember John Vasconcellos, who personally began feeling, through his own work in therapy, that low self-esteem was the cause for dropouts, teenage pregnancy, drug abuse, and all kinds of social problems. And he got the government to start using self-esteem raising strategies in schools, in curricula. And so there has been a huge emphasis on high self-esteem since, this was after I left school, but since 1985. And it's paid off, in a sense, in what you see as the tournament where everyone gets a trophy.
Mm, this is the everyone is special movement.
Special snowflake. And that's what I see. At the same time, though, there are a lot of people who that didn't work on, and who feel perhaps even worse because all around them so many more people have so much self-esteem. There is recent studies that show that self-esteem has risen greatly since the 1980s, and that college students have twice the self-esteem they had in 1982, something like that. But those of us who struggle with low self-esteem look around ourselves, see how high the standard self-esteem, the ambient self-esteem of our peers are, and makes us feel even worse.
So this is odd because, on the other hand, America is often described as a narcissistic culture. You know, and you look around and there are millions of people taking selfies and tweeting their every thought and action and posting mundane details of their lives on Facebook. We look like a culture of people who like themselves a lot.
I think because, to a large part, especially thanks to the self-esteem movement, which is now a huge self-esteem industry, we are. But it hasn't worked on everyone. And the high self-esteem that others were given and that they have and enjoy has allowed many people to be better bullies. So the higher the self-esteem of those around us, the more capable they feel of abusing us in various ways, which can lower our self-esteem.
Do you ever wonder if there's something narcissistic about self-loathing, intense self-criticism? I mean, it's negative and deeply painful, but it's still a form of excessive self-regard.
Definitely. And I have known people who were honestly suicidally filled with low self-esteem. Yes. And what I did say to them unsuccessfully was, in various ways, it's not really all about you. The impression you have that you're a terrible person that's going to bring the earth down with your terribleness, A, is a waste of your time. Just look at the flowers and have a nice time instead. And B, you're just presuming so much about other people and your importance to them. What a relief and a release to realize that we're not that important to others. Yes, low self-esteem, self-loathing is a form of self-obsession. It's a form of self-absorption. That's why it's just as, quote unquote, bad as being a fascist dictator who commandeers genocides.
Anna Lee Rufus is the author of Unworthy: How to Stop Hating Yourself. That's it for our conversation about narcissism. But coming up, the well-known atheist Sam Harris has surprised a lot of people by writing a book in praise of spirituality. That's on our minds, along with this week's dangerous idea. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
Hi, my name is Marcelo Gleiser. I'm a theoretical physicist and I work at Dartmouth College. And my dangerous idea is that we matter. We humans matter a lot in the universe. And that goes against what we call Copernicanism, which is the notion that we don't matter, that the more we learn about the universe, the less important we become. And it's kind of fascinating that this question of do we matter or not, is tied up with the question of life in the universe. And, of course, the idea that there may be life out there is extremely old and has gotten a lot of people into trouble, like Giordano Bruno, who was burned at the stake for many reasons, but one of them being that he believed that every star was a sun and there were planets around it with people. And are there planets around there with people? So when we look out into our galaxy, the Milky Way, you find hundreds of billions of stars. And now we know, and something we didn't know, say, 20 years ago, that the vast majority of these stars, they do have planets circling them. So the question then becomes, with so many worlds out there, you can talk about a trillion worlds in our galaxy alone, and then there are hundreds of billions of other galaxies out there. Shouldn't life be everywhere? Earth is a planet like very few others, where you have liquid water and you have nice warm temperatures on the surface that are sustained over thousands and thousands of years. And that allows not just for life to appear, but for complex life to appear. And so as we search for life in other planets, and most certainly there should be some kind of life out there, we shouldn't be that important over here, you start to realize that Earth and the history of life here on Earth are part of a really remarkable story. And that story is the story that led from very simple organisms to human beings. And I call this human centrism, not in the sense that we are the center of the universe, like Columbus, for example, thought in the 1500s and everybody else, but in the sense that we matter because we are these molecular machines that are capable of higher thinking and of realizing how important we are in the big scheme of things. So we port this notion to the 21st century and to global warming and to how threatened our planet is and the species in this planet is. And we realize that by looking at the Earth from the outside perspective of how rare it is and how rare we are, we develop a new sort of cosmic moral imperative, which is to preserve life, to be the guardians of life. So humanity should be guarding life at all costs. Otherwise, it may disappear here, and chances are there may not be any as interesting as ourselves out there.
Theoretical physicist Marcelo Gleiser with his dangerous idea. You can find more dangerous ideas and an interview with Gleiser on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. Neuroscientist Sam Harris is best known as the guy who helped launch the new atheist movement. His first book, The End of Faith, was a fierce attack on organized religion, so it's kind of a shock to see the title of his new book. It's called Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion. Steve Paulson wanted to know why Sam Harris would write a book in favor of a spiritual life.
Sam, you are a very prominent atheist, so it's going to surprise a lot of people that you've written a book about spirituality. I mean, a lot of atheists and humanists despise that word. They consider any talk about spirituality as an invitation to mushy thinking. Do you see that as a problem?
Yeah, I do, because as you say, atheists have an association with this term that deems it more or less synonymous with a belief in a soul that can survive brain death or ghosts and etc. Ironically, some of the more prominent atheists have used the term spirituality without much apology. People like Christopher Hitchens and Carl Sagan, they didn't use it in my sense, but they both used it to describe experiences of meaning or beauty that they found too potent for ordinary terms, like the view through the Hubble Deep Field image. I don't actually use spirituality in that sense because I think that is somewhat misleading. I would like to reserve the term for the efforts that people can make to deeply transform their moment-to-moment experience of the world through disciplined techniques of introspection like meditation.
But you're saying that there's something missing in everyone's life, atheist or not, if they don't have some sense of the spiritual in their own lives?
Yeah, well, I think there's deeply transformative experiences of, for instance, unconditional love. You know, if you wake up tomorrow morning feeling more love than you ever have for anybody, for all of humanity, for whatever reason, you've got knocked on the head or you have been on a meditation retreat or you took MDMA, I mean, something has perturbed your nervous system, and now you are open to a fundamentally different perception of yourself and the world. And unfortunately, there's almost no place in our culture, there really is no place in our culture where you can have that experience apart from one or another Iron Age religion or New Age cult. And that's a problem for the forces of reason because people have these experiences. They are often, very often, the most important experiences they ever have in their lives. And we atheists have more or less deemed them inadmissible.
And yet there's a whole category of people who call themselves spiritual but not religious. I mean, you know, in surveys, that's actually a fairly large percentage of how people now define themselves. You seem to be part of that group in a way.
Yeah. Depending on how the question gets asked, it's about 20%. And clearly, there are some problems there because much of what people believe in the name of spirituality is as dogmatic and as superstitious as what other people believe in the name of religion. And so that's really the basis for the atheist or skeptical reaction against this term. At the core of these experiences, I argue, is the phenomenon of self-transcendence, the fact that the self that we think we all have, the sense of I, the sense of me behind my eyes, looking out at the world that's other than what I am, that can be cut through. That is, there's an experience of self-transcendence, which is the loss of that feeling of separateness. And that really lies at the core of many religious traditions, and that really is the center of the bullseye for spirituality.
Now, I was surprised to hear that you've wanted to write this book for years. I mean, this gets very personal for you, right?
Yeah, well, before I became a noted atheist, I was someone who was deeply interested in experiences of this kind. I spent about 2 years on silent meditation retreats in my 20s, mostly in a Buddhist context, but not exclusively.
And this is where you would sometimes meditate for, what, 12 or even 18 hours a day?
Yeah. Most of these were Vipassana retreats, which the principal export of which is now this concept of mindfulness, which you see very much in vogue now in the West. The better you get at this, the more you begin to see that this sense of there being a center to experience, the sense that there's a thinker who is thinking the thoughts or a hearer who's hearing sounds, that begins to break down. And it can break down in a way that really is decisive, where it is absolutely clear that the sense of I has dropped away.
Now, what you haven't said is that it led to experiences of rapture, of ecstasy. I mean, those kinds of peak experiences that some people say happens when they have an experience of enlightenment.
Yeah, well, it does. But those experiences are never the point. And now it can be hard to understand this when you're having those experiences. So you've
had those experiences.
Oh, yeah. And I've had those experiences with and without the benefit of pharmacology. So there's a chapter in the book on psychedelics. And you've
sampled quite a number, right? I mean, from ecstasy to psilocybin and LSD.
Yeah. And a number of times of each.
Were those psychedelic experiences formative for you?
Well, they were in the sense that they advertised to me in a very startling and unequivocal way that it was possible to have a very different experience of life. And I was a sufficiently lumpen character that I needed that kind of sledgehammer blow to convince me that there was something worth paying attention to in the nature of my own mind. People have to read my book or my blog to know the full story here, because I can't recommend them totally without caveat, because obviously there are dangers with any drugs. But the unique power of psychedelics is that something is guaranteed to happen. I mean, boredom is just simply not on the table. And so if you take 100 micrograms of LSD, something is going to change about your experience. Now, it can be a terrifying change, and in some cases it is. But if it's a positive change, it will be a change of a sort that convinces you that it's possible to be far more at ease in the universe and in your life and with other people than you've tended to be. Because this is the problem with meditation or any other more subtle technique of spiritual practice. There's no guarantee it's going to work for you.
It's hard work, too.
Yeah, it's hard work, and some people have an aptitude for it, some people don't. Now, the chief obstacle to meditation, really any style of meditation, is the fact that we are lost in thought virtually every second of our waking lives. We're just thinking since the moment we get out of bed in the morning, and we don't notice it. So the enemy of wisdom, the enemy of noticing what you want to notice, is distraction and thought.
You know what I find fascinating about what you're saying is, I mean, to some degree, you're talking about getting rid of your thoughts during contemplative practice, and yet you live through your thinking. I mean, you know, you're a widely recognized public intellectual, you know, with an incisive, critical mind. I mean, thinking is your bread and butter. How do you square these two sides of your life?
Well, it's not so much getting rid of thoughts. It's no longer being identified with thought. It's recognizing thought, as it arises in consciousness. And if you're anything like me, most of your thoughts are unhappy thoughts. I mean, but there's probably some lucky listeners out there who think happy thoughts all day long, and for whom, you know, much of this isn't going to make sense because they're just satisfied with their lives and they love everybody and they see no benefit to getting out of the prison of thought. But for most of us, thinking is like being kidnapped by the most boring person on earth and being told the same story over and over again. I mean, if you can imagine if your thoughts were broadcast on a monitor for other people to hear. I mean, you tell
God
yourself
forbid.
The same.
Yeah.
Yeah. You repeat the same anecdote, the same incident, 15 different ways. If other people could hear this or see these images, you would seem completely insane. And yet, because it's in the privacy of our own mind, we think this is completely normal. Now, it begins not to seem normal when you discover an alternative, which is you can actually just break the spell. You can cease to be lost in this negative dream. The sooner you can break the spell, the sooner you have a choice between being the angry guy or the person who's over it.
We are almost out of time, but there's one last question I want to ask you. Near the end of the book, you say, spirituality remains the great whole in secularism, humanism, rationalism, atheism. Are you saying that the atheist movement is ready for the next stage to figure out how to fill that hole?
Yeah. This comes down to the question of what will replace religion. And I think something has to replace religion because we have to get out of our tribal affiliations. We have to make the basis for religious conflict unthinkable. And the way to do that is to capture everything people think they need out of religion in some other form. And much of that's happening anyway in art and literature and entertainment and the rest of culture. You know, you don't need religion to give you community. You don't need religion to be moral. The one missing piece for many people is these kinds of experiences. We're all playing this game. It's just few of us actually recognize the structure of the game. And when you do recognize the structure, that you're just trying to get back to the present moment and find a reason enough to be happy here, then that gives you a reason to train your mind explicitly to pay attention to the present moment differently.
We need to leave it there. We are out of time. Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, thank you, Steve. It's been a pleasure.
Sam Harris talking with Steve Paulson about his book, Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion. And if you'd like to hear Sam's thoughts about the nature of consciousness or his take on near-death experiences, you can listen to the full, uncut interview on our website. That's at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced today's show, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, and audio engineer Brittany True. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.